Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
The voice of the Cameroonian woman must and will be heard in all corners of the globe. The time has come when we must make our contribution so that when history is written, the Cameroonian woman will have an honorable place in its pages. Welcome to the African Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Madina Thiam. The excerpt I just read was part of a speech delivered in 1965 by Anna Foncha, the wife of Cameroonian statesman John Gou Foncha. It is quoted in the introduction of the new book, Gender, Separatist Politics, and Embodied Nationalism in Cameroon, which came out in 2019 with the University of Michigan Press. I am very pleased to be joined on the podcast today by the author of this book, Dr. Jacqueline Bethel Chutamugwe, an assistant professor of African Cultural Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Mugwe, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. I'm really happy to have you on.
Thank you for having me today.
So can you begin by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit more about your personal background and also about your training?
Yes, I was born in Cameroon, a West Central African country, but moved to the United States in the early 1990s when I was a child. And since childhood, one of the things that I really wanted to become when I grew up was to be a painter. So essentially to be sort of this free roaming artist. But as perhaps you might know, or perhaps have had this experience, as a child of immigrants, particularly African immigrants, this idea about being a free roaming artist did not sit well with my father, who, would always say, you know, I struggled to come to the U.S. and so on. And, you know, my child's not going to grow up to just draw, right? So one of the things that he wanted me to become was a doctor, not a lawyer, but a doctor. So naturally, I rebelled and chose to do history. And so, but unfortunately, through my undergraduate years, I told him I was pre-med. And I told him only after I had graduated with a history degree that I was actually a history major, and I told him in front of colleagues and friends in my graduation party, so that way I would survive the encounter. And it was an interesting experience when I finally got my PhD, and we were celebrating, you know, my first position. It was at this point that he said, "Oh, I guess people can make money teaching history." And so it was this sort of my sort of journey to finally coming into the field of history. But one of the things that I focus on in my own work is on African gender history or on African women's history. And the journey to that specific focus was a little bit different. And so I received my PhD in history from Purdue University, as well as a graduate certificate in women's gender and sexuality studies from Purdue University. And essentially taking classes in that program led me down the road to start to focus on how individuals in Africa construct their self-identity through ideas about gender norms. And so in general, my research focus is looking at how individuals in Africa develop or construct ideas about self-identity through political actions, religious beliefs, or bodily practices, such as through clothing. And I use a specific gender lens, or I use a gender lens in order to examine those actions or those historical narratives. And the main issue that I address or want to resolve in my work is to understand the role of gender and how individuals have developed this sense of identity in the past. But most importantly, how this can help us understand modern day events, right? So not just leaving the past in the past, but making this a clear connection between what happened in the past and what's going on today. And looking at this sort of making of these different ideas of how people understand themselves, I have found it very useful to look at these narratives through a gender lens. And I really started that journey when I was taking these classes at Purdue, these classes on gender history, on African feminist history. And really, my eyes really opened up when I took a graduate course on African feminism. I just fell instantly in love with the topic. And as a Cameroon-born woman, I started to understand how feminism is of great importance to African women, but how African women themselves have understood feminism in a really different way. And so have understood feminism in ways that we may not recognize within Western discourses or within or in the US. And I started to use that frame of analysis not only in my dissertation, but just how I look at my academic work in general. What does African gender history look like? What does African feminist history look like? And these are some of the themes that I tease out in my recently published book.
Mm-hmm. And so specifically for that project, what was the genesis? You set up for us, I guess, your progression through graduate school and mm-hmm. asking these important questions of what is African feminism? How does it shape people's social relations? How does gender shape our social relations? So for this specific project, how did it come to be?
Yeah, so it was a really interesting and fascinating journey, and it wasn't one which I saw. So when I first decided to go to graduate school for history, I actually wanted to focus on the U.S. Civil War. Not an African history. I don't know why. I think I just didn't been watching a lot of documentaries on it. And so that's actually what I decided to do. And I applied to graduate school late because I was still deciding what I really wanted to do. And when I got to graduate school, within a semester, I switched to focusing on Sudan. I had taken a graduate level course in which we were asked to write a research paper, and I wrote my paper on gender and violence in Sudan. And so I started doing research on Sudanese women's history. And at some point when I was doing research on the women of Sudan, I thought, I have no idea about the history of women in Cameroon. And it just made me feel, at some point I became uncomfortable, and I thought, okay, here I am writing the history of women in another country, and I have no idea about the history of my aunts, you know, my grandmothers. And so I started on that journey, and I decided I'm going to focus on Cameroonian women's history. But the problem was that the way I understood Cameroonian history was very biased. It was very slanted. I did not understand it at that point, that what I knew was the little Cameroonian history I did know, it was Cameroonian Francophone history. So the history that, you know, my father had told me, or the history that my family members had told me. And so I thought when I first started out on this dissertation topic that I was just going to be focusing on Cameroonian women's history, and it was going to be by default Cameroonian Francophone women's history. And I started to sort of get an inkling of the problems in this perspective when I send out a question on HNET. So, you know, back in the days, the HNET listserv was the place to be. And so, and that's where I was. And so I send out this question to my Cameroonian listserv. And there started to be this question about which Cameroonian woman are you speaking about? Are you speaking about English-speaking women, French-speaking women? Are you speaking about women in the North? And I thought, okay, I seem to have made a really fatal research mistake. And I was thinking of that when I went to Cameroon to do research about these sort of inkling about the two different histories of the Cameroon. And so I started out by going to the archives in Yaoundé, so the Francophone capital of the country. And I was just, you know, just searching through all these various materials about gender and women. And what I mostly found was historical narratives about Francophone Cameroon. And so I didn't really follow up on this sort of, you know, intuition or this sort of inkling that other people were trying to sort of share with me about these very diverse histories of Cameroon until I was invited to vacation in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon, which I had never stepped foot in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon until I was conducting dissertation field research. And I went there and I stayed with close family friends and the woman who's like an aunt to me said, you know, there are archives here in Boya, so a large English-speaking town in Cameroon. And she said, there are archives up in the mountains. Why don't you go and check out these national archives? And I said, but I've already been at the national archives. What do you mean? And she kept insisting, and she finally dragged me there. And I realized, okay, first, Cameroon has more than one national archives. And second, it just completely opened up my eyes, the things I found there. I really honestly couldn't believe the things that I was finding. All of this information about the history of the region of Cameroon that was formerly under British rule, all of this newspapers, and then embedded in these newspapers were all these vibrant conversations about gender roles, women's history, Cameroonian political history. The archives had all these images and all these photos I had never seen. I mean, it just, for me, for someone who is so new to this topic, it was shocking because I had been told before I left to go to Cameroon by my dissertation advisors that, listen, here you are planning to conduct field research, but know that you may not find what you want to find. Know that you may have to switch your topic. Essentially, they were preparing me to be flexible, to change my topic or to change my approach. And what I found was not, originally what I thought was going to be a good, you know, treasure trove for Francophone Cameroon history. What I found was just this amazing amount of resources on Anglophone Cameroonian. I had so many resources, or had access to so many primary sources that I honestly didn't even know where to even begin. So I had the opposite problem of what my dissertation advisors had told me. I had the problem of, as I had too many resources. I had the Francophone, I had resources from the research of former French ruled Cameroon, and also from the formerly British ruled areas. And it was a lot. And so what I started to do was essentially to just look through as many resources as I could. And I didn't always necessarily read my resources or at the archives. I was just too busy taking a lot of notes. And it wasn't until I left Cameroon and really sat down to look at my notes that I was really surprised, shocked, and delighted at the resources that I found.
Wow. It's really, you took a lot of turns before reaching that project, which in a way, as a graduate student, it's kind of reassuring to hear that it wasn't all figured out from the beginning.
Yes. And one of the best advice I got was from a fellow colleague who parents were from Africa. She told me that when conducting field research, that I need to be open to the networks and connections that my family members try to facilitate for me. And she said, don't be annoyed, just go through with the process. And so It was really my family that said, go to Boya, go to the English speaking parts, go and, you know, take a break and perhaps there'll be things there. And I thought, no. And I remembered, this advice. And so once I followed through on it and they started sort of facilitating networks and connections, I thought, okay, yeah. You know, sometimes when you leave to go conduct field research, you think you're going to do one thing and you end up doing something else. But also it's a very different experience when you're someone that's was born in that country or has family members in that country. The turns that you take can also be very different from someone who's not from there or was not born there or has family there.
Mm-hmm. Can you set up for us the political and administrative situation during colonization and at the time of independence of the territory that is now the Republic of Cameroon? I think mm-hmm. it will really help us understand all these distinctions that you just talked about between Anglophone and Francophone and that how that shaped your research. So what is this history? What happened there?
So the French take the larger eastern part of Cameroon and the British take the smaller western part. And the smaller western part is where my research lands. It's the geographic focus of my book. And this part of Cameroon, so the western part, is split into two. Overall, it's known as the British Cameroons. The northern part is known as the Northern Cameroons. The southern part is known as the Southern Cameroons. And the southern part specifically is the focus of my book because the northern parts of Cameroon eventually joins Nigeria. And the southern part eventually joins the recently independent French-ruled region of the country. And they do that in 1961. But to be clear, the independence movements for each part, for each region is slightly different. There's been lots of research showing that the French-ruled area engaged in a violent and brutal struggle for independence from French rule. And there's been a lot of other research showing that formal independence in the British-ruled areas happened in a very different way. And as I mentioned, the southern part joins the newly independent French-ruled area and the northern part is newly independent Nigeria, which is a story for another time. It's a very fascinating story. But when the southern part joins the former French Cameroon, they form the Federal Republic of Cameroon. And that happens in October 1961. And this is where the timeline in my book really begins. So it covers that time period between 1961 and 1972 when Cameroon was officially a federal republic. And it's really fascinating because, yes, you have now Cameroon, which is essentially kind of unified, but now you have two federal states. So the unified country comprises of the English-speaking West Cameroon state and the French-speaking East Cameroon state. And each state has its own government, laws, systems of measurement, official language, social and financial system. They even drive on opposite sides of the road. And this is where you start to see political tensions. So between 1961 and 1972, during this time period, you have an overarching president of the republic. So the Francophone president, and he's known as Amadou Ahidjo, and he's a Muslim from Northern Cameroon. He leads the entire Francophone Republic. He's the president, but he also leads the Francophone Eastern Federal State. The vice president is John Fancha. So he's a vice president of the entire Federal Republic, but simultaneously, he's also the vice president of the Anglophone Western Federal States. So throughout the 1960s, what you start to see is a larger and more powerful Francophone state or the French-speaking state start to assert a more aggressive stance towards the Anglophone state or the English-speaking state. And this starts to cause fear and anxiety among Anglophone elites of formally educated urbanized that Anglophone or English-speaking cultural values, national identity, and self-determination was really at stake. And really, Anglophone elites rightly feared the hegemonic plans of the Francophone state. Because between 1961 and 1972, what you see is a Francophone president of the republic increasingly sidelines Anglophone political elites. He also bans the multi-party system in 1966, which bans all parties in the country, so not just the Anglophone ones. And so it becomes a one-party state. And essentially his formation of the Unitary Republic, the United Republic of Cameroon in 1972, effectively brings English-speaking regions under his rule. And so my work analyzes how do the Anglophone political elites between 1961 and 1972, how do they develop this idea of their national identity? And what roles do women play in that? And I argue that women play a very powerful role in that. And we actually see the effects and the influence of that today in Cameroon. What many people think of as Anglophone Cameroon identity today, these were what you would say recipes that were cooked up in women's kitchens in 1960s Anglophone speaking regions of Cameroon. They were stitched together in ideas about what the Anglophone national costume is. These were ideas that were developed and made by women political elites in English speaking parts of Cameroon. They really worked hard to basically answer this broad question of who are we as a people? And so they're putting together this sort of colorful puzzle of what Anglophone cultural national identity is between 1961 and 1972. And I really, really honestly believe that their idea, their development of Anglophone national identity and cultural identity is what survives today, or elements of it is what survives today, even more than the male-dominated political parties. And that gets me in trouble at conferences when there's men in the audience and they're like, are you trying to tell us that women's political actions are more powerful, you know, so powerful that it still resonates today? And I say, yes, absolutely. And that doesn't always play off really well.
So women's political action, there's an important series of events that predate the main developments that you discuss in the book that happened in the late colonial period, and that is the Anglo Rebellion. Mm-hmm. And you touch on it. So can you explain to us, what was this rebellion and why was it important?
Yeah, I include the story of the Anglo Rebellion in the book because one of the reviewers said, you know, you really need to talk about women's traditional organizations. You can't talk about these formal political organizations without acknowledging that they're also drawing from local traditions about women's political power. And so when I went back and took a look at my sources, you know, of course, the reviewer was absolutely right. And so I point to the Anglo Rebellion because it shows us the important political roles that women have played in Cameroon and in Africa in general. But also it's a very juicy story, and so which is why I was very much attracted to it. And so I point to this event in my book essentially to say, hey, look, Cameroonian women have always been politically active as individuals and as a collective group. And they have always been creative in how they access these longstanding political powers, and also have always been creative in how they create new access to various ideas of political powers. So if we look at the Anglo Rebellion, really briefly, what we have are several key characters in this story, right? So the women themselves, the British administrative officials, but also most importantly, the local African men who were part of two political parties. So the Cameroon National Congress, known as the KNC, and the Cameroon National Democratic Party, the KNDP. And so the KNC and the KNDP were battling for political power of British ruled regions of Cameroon. So we have sort of these three, you know, groups of characters that are key to the story. And so between 1958 and 1961, which were the final years of British rule in Western Cameroon, women in the grass field regions fought against essentially two forms of, I would say, political oppression. So one against British rule and the second against local African men who had political power. And their strategies for sort of in this time period was really fascinating. So let's begin with why the women were upset. So what we see is during this time period, the women cast aside their regular domestic and agricultural duties, essentially to engage in a revolt against the British administrative interference in agriculture, which was normally their domain, so a space where they got social and political power, and to revolt also against the alleged plan. So there were rumors and gossip that the ruling political party at that time, the KNC, was going to sell land to Nigerians. So the women were upset about, you know, being forced to change how they farmed, and then there are all these rumors about their lands being given away. And it's what they start to do is to, essentially is to employ a centuries-old women's organization that was usually deployed or used against people who violated the moral code in that region. And that was known as the Anlu. And so the women got together. And so I just want to be clear, Anlu is not essentially, it's not a permanent women's organization. It's essentially employed in doing times of crisis, you know, whether it's moral crisis, social crisis, now political crisis. They get together and they use all sorts of fascinating strategies during this time period. And there's been a lot of research that concludes that the women start to support the KNDP party and to fight against the KNC party, because the KNDP party, they feel, is going to allow them to keep their land. And so they throw their political support that way. And so they use all sorts of strategy to combat KNC supporters, but also local male elites. And so their strategies is, you know, I found this to be very juicy. It included stripping naked in front of men. You have local men who consider the sight of the vagina in public to be a very bad sign. And they understood the seriousness of the revolt. But, you know, the surprised British officials at the start of this uprising were surprised. They weren't sure about the political intentions or the seriousness of thousands of women getting naked. And the women also started to interfere with the burial rituals of male political elites. They heard insults at men. They demanded the closing of schools where they thought that the teachers were KNC supporters. They demanded the closing of schools and of courts and markets. They set up roadblocks. They destroyed and burned properties. They went as far as whenever a man walked by, they would actually pinch his butt. I mean, essentially, it was where gender norms were turned upside down, but there was space for that. That's what happened when Anlu was employed. There was this general understanding in space that women had that power to express serious political or social or moral grievances. And so essentially by disturbing local and political power and by protesting against British rule in the Southern Cameroons, the women are able into many ways to express their political independence and autonomy, but to also usher this important victory for the KNDP in 1961. It's the KNDP at the dawn of independence that has political power, and it's these women that sort of usher or they facilitate this process. But to be clear, the women are also exercising their own political power themselves. Many of the women that were part of this movement. The leaders that were part of this movement, one of them goes on to become a powerful judge. the women demand that the former capital and the Western Grassville regions is actually changed. It's relocated to a different place. I mean, so there was very, what I'm trying to say is that it wasn't just about supporting male dominated political party. And at the end, it wasn't just about the KNDP coming to power. Women themselves were able to exercise their political voice and to actually get political power themselves, particularly the leaders.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So something you make clear in the book is that although the Anglo Rebellion is a very important prehistory of women's politics and nationalist politics after independence, the context and the strategies also that women use became different. And to describe all of this, you come up with the concept of embodied nationalism. Mm. So what was embodied nationalism and how did it manifest in Cameroon in the early era of independence?
I think it's really important to actually begin first with the journey or the process for that. Understanding of what embodied nationalism was. For me, when I was looking at the primary sources, there was so much about women's emotions and how they should behave. When I say behave, I mean like smiling, how they should smell, what type of perfume they should wear. And all of these sort of everyday bodily actions were being connected to ideas about cultural values, but also to the nation. And a lot of the sources that I found would have these really juicy titles, right, which would draw me to them. So one of them would say something about like, you know, women who are shy in public they embarrass Cameroonian culture, right? You know, you shouldn't be shy in public. You should be able to have, you know, you should be able to intellectually carry a conversation. You should smile, but you shouldn't smile too much. That way, men and women think that you're sexually loose, right? And so there were all these conversations about just, you know, these everyday bodily actions and what that meant for the nation, what that meant for cultural values. And I saw these conversations happening and I was reading about them as a graduate student, but I didn't really know what to do with them, right? I just knew that there were all these stories about being shy, you know, smiling and not smiling too much, you know, being able to drink but not drinking too much, that way you were drunk and, you know, in public. And it wasn't until I, you know, received the reviews for my book and one of the reviewers said, you know, the first half of the book, great, interesting, connects to the argument. Second half of the book with the woman, with the housewives running around chasing their husband's mistresses and the slacks and like there needs to be sort of a bridge, right? A way to connect women's everyday behaviors and bodily actions to the nation building campaigns. And this is when I actually went back to my notes that I took as a graduate student when I was actually a pre-doctoral fellow at Northwestern University. We had to give presentations on our chapters from our dissertation, and the people that happened to be in the audience a lot of the time in the program of African studies were anthropologists and political scientists. They were the ones giving me feedback. And so they really would say, you know, they would try to push me to look at these everyday and bodily actions within a particular framework. And I went back to those notes and I went back to some of the presentations I had given. And I thought, aha, here I am talking about national embodiment and clothing. So I actually went back to the notes I had taken in 2012 played around with that idea of how can I better connect the second half of the book to the first half. And this idea about embodying nationalism started to sort of crystallize, or my understanding of it anyway started to crystallize. And so stories about English speaking Cameroon's early post-colonial history, both scholarship and those, with a wider audience, tend to focus on the actions of men who have had power. And even during the period of focus in the book, men who served as, prime ministers, vice presidents, and high-ranking civil servants were openly part of politics, and there've been all this work about how they created nationalism in English-speaking parts of Cameroon, but they often leave out women's roles. And so I felt that one thing I wanted to focus on was to reframe understanding of Cameroon's history during this time period by looking at how women, so the wives of men who had power, women states, bureaucrats, journalists, and political activists did access social and political powers in ways previously not known or talked about. So essentially female political elites. So that left me with several questions. What type of spaces did these women carve out for themselves, and how did they enter these spaces? And in order to answer these questions, or in order to answer the reviewers' questions, I started to see that formally educated women access social and political power by invoking this sort of idea about how women's emotional expression and visual representation through, for instance, food, dress, and suitable conduct did absolutely matter in how they understood what national identity was. And so they were invoking these ideas about embodied nationalism, which is this concept that I understood as a type of nationalism in which you have identities that can be embodied through performance, emotional expression, affection, and visual representation. But I do want to be clear that you have several scholars who have wrestled the phrase or notion of embodied nationalism. What I do in the book is I expand understandings of this term, and I provide a more concrete definition that simultaneously emphasizes emotional expression, affectional bonds, and visual representation. And I from when I was revising my book as a pre-doctoral fellow, I started to see and understood through conversations with political scientists, and particularly that this sort of idea about how the nation is embodied, or how how emotional expressions does matter to how the nation is understood, is not just occurring in Cameroon or in African countries. These ideas that I sort of grapple with or discuss in the book, they resonate beyond Cameroon and beyond Africa. And I really think that Cameroon then becomes a really fascinating case study to understand women's roles in, for example, separatist or secessionist projects around the world. And I look to examples in Quebec with the Quebec sovereignty movement, and into the various independence movements that have taken place in Puerto Rico. If we look at Cameroon and then sort of, look at women or female political elites in other areas of the world that are also grappling with how can we get greater autonomy or within, a hegemonic state. What unique roles do women play in that? How do women access these roles in a very different way than when they access political roles doing independence movements in Cameroon, but also in Africa in general. What does that look like in the post-colonial context?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thinking of what it looks like in the book, you show really well that this national identity building that female West Cameroon political elites champion shows up in all kinds of areas. Mm-hmm. So one of these areas, it's food and women's culinary skills. Another area is women's marriages. And you'll talk about it in a second. You talk about it. What I told you was my favorite chapter of the book. I thought it did have like the juiciest title, this chapter.
The one about food, right?
Not the one about food, but the one about marriages, one that you titled, "My Husband Stopped Mating Me, Beat Up His Girl." But so, yeah, and you really develop that also, that how that's one of your quotes in the book, how a respectable home functions as the Anglophone nation Brits mall. So can you explain that to us a little bit? How did things such as cooking or women's marital and extramarital relations come to relate to Anglophone nationhood?
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite parts of the research, and I very much enjoyed writing that chapter because particularly when I was originally conducting research for that, I had the experience of being in the archives and then reading these historical narratives, leaving the archives and then seeing a continuation of a lot of the issues that were happening in the 1960s occurring in 2011 or in 2012 when I was conducting my dissertation field research. And that was the case with issues about food and cooking. I could easily connect the archive with my everyday life experience when I was in Cameroon and the everyday life experiences of the women and men around me. And it became really clear to me that in 1960s Cameroon, Cameroonian cuisine becomes important in essentially cooking understandings of what the nation is. And if we first understand that women are often seen to represent the nation, right? And they're often seen to authentically represent the nation. And one of the ways in which they do this is not only by reproducing, but also culturally reproducing the nation. It then becomes, you know, easier to understand why cooking plays a really critical role or is a critical ingredient in understandings of what the nation is and what that looks like. So something that's like a mundane activity that's done at home, it is very much connected to the nation. It's very much, can very much be politicized. And so your kitchen then can become the nation writ large. And what women cook and the ingredients that they use says much about their identity or the family's identity, but also how the culture and the nation can be represented on the global level. And it just was fascinating to me that when I was conducting research for this and reading the sources, that these female political elites are actually coming together to make essentially what's an Anglophone national cookbook, and taking recipes not only from local areas but also from French-speaking regions of Cameroon and from Nigeria. And it was fascinating to me that this idea about what is the national cuisine is really something that is put together in the kitchen. It's not something, there's no inherent understanding of it across time and space. And so a lot of the food that we think of that represent Cameroon, these are cuisines that were essentially selected during the 1960s. You had female journalists that literally asked, what is our national cuisine here? Nigeria has theirs. Ethiopia has theirs. These other parts of of the African continent have their national cuisine. What is ours? These other parts of the continent have their national costumes. What is ours? And so they would literally pose these questions, and people would submit letters to the newspaper saying, well, I think it should be this, right? And then I think it should be called this. And other people would then respond and say, well, I don't think it should be called this. You know, it should be called that. And so it was just fascinating to see how female political elites were leading the making of national cuisines, but also how everyday people, or really everyday literate people, were engaging in these conversations by writing into newspapers. But so you have that going on, sort of, you know, how can food represent the nation, but within sort of more domestic spaces or in gender or with gender relations, food also plays a critical role. And so it shapes these intimate everyday gender relations and expectations about ideal womanhood. And when I was conducting research, people would say, oh, Francophone Cameroon women don't know how to cook. They don't know how to take care of the house. And they would look at me in the eyes and they would say this, right? And wow. I'd be like, no, I'd find myself defending myself, you know, I would think I'm supposed to be doing research, right? And I'd say, no, I know how to cook this and that, and no, I can really sweep, but I can do this, right? But there were all these stereotypes, and it became clear to me that throughout Cameroon, it doesn't matter what culture you're from. What I've seen, what I read, is that cooking is an important part of understandings of ideal womanhood in Cameroon. And at this time, the ideal woman cooked for her family, cooked for her husband. And if she was married specifically, she cooked her husband's food for herself with her own hand. Even if they could afford help, even if they could afford a cook, there was this emphasis that the wife must cook her husband's food herself, and that if she did not do that, that she was not fulfilling expected gender norms. And if you did not fulfill the expected gender norms, then you know, why be surprised if your husband then engages in extramarital affairs? Because then perhaps, you know, I'm representing sort of the conversations in my research, right? And so, for example, the some of the female journalists will say, well, perhaps it's the husband's mistress who knows how to cook really well, right? So perhaps you should step up your game. Or perhaps, you know, she's making the different dishes, different types of dishes every single day. You know, step up your game and also make different dishes every single day. But it really was a key role in sort of helping to forge ideas about gender relations or expected gender relations in this time period, particularly in the time period for the book. But it was also about beyond that, it was also about, you know, it was also about how did the food you cook represent your status? And so you have these formally educated women that are also being told, you need to prove that just because you have a PhD or just because you're a lawyer, you need to prove that you can also fulfill ideal womanhood, like traditional ones, that you can also cook, you know, that you also want to have kids. That you do want to get married. However, you have a formal education, so you also need to show that you can cook British style pudding, right? And so you would have these different conversations telling women when they should cook local traditional food, when they should cook Western style food, and it depended on the circumstances.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of these discussions still happen today, right? Absolutely. In a lot of contexts, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, some of the really compelling sources that you use also throughout the book are newspaper columns written mm-hmm. by female journalists mm-hmm. who you call print griots. Mm-hmm. So who are these print griots and what was their impact?
Yeah, well to begin with, griots in West Africa, as we understand them, you know, there are professional storytellers, poets, and musicians, and they're also professional historians. And both men and women can be griots. But there's been research that shows that, you know, there's been a general absence of discussions about female griots and scholarship on African oral tradition. And in conducting research and also presenting parts of my book at conferences, I realized that, you know, upon a closer look, that specifically English-speaking or, you know, Anglophone Cameroonian women journalists drew from local oral traditions, local storytelling approaches to tell stories about Cameroonians' past, and to specifically tell stories about Cameroonian women's history, African women's history, ideas about how gender relations or gender norms were in the past, and connecting that to the present day period. And saying, hey, look, women were queens before German colonialism, and queens could do X, Y, Z. Thus, there can be a female parliamentarian today in, you know, 1960s Cameroon because of this long history of women having political power. And so I saw these women as essentially being griots, so print griots, and it allowed me to see how they reimagined or they restitched Africa's past through these, you know, anecdotes and stories that were being shared with them from family, friends, and community members, and just really embedding themselves within this broader West African culture in which, you know, griots were professional storytellers about the past. And looking at them as print griot provided a unique lens to see how women writers, journalists, novelists, cookbook authors, for instance, really combined these local ideas about oral traditions with their background of being formally educated in Western style Christian schools. Usually at this time period in the 1960s, it was happening during British rule, and how the combination of all these different and diverse influences about understanding the past, understanding gender norms collided, and how they understood how they told stories about Cameroon's past, and how essentially this was a form of power, and the best example of how this was a form of power is that you would have male readers. It was often male readers who were writing into these newspapers in the 1960s because it was usually men who were formally educated and doing British rule. So of course in 1960, they were the ones writing in, and they would say, oh, you know, I want to challenge you on this history about women being queens in the past, or I want to challenge you about the fact that in Cameroon's past, men and women actually divided their earnings equally, or, and so they were often challenging their interpretations about the past. And that really, you know, was sort of this, it really highlighted for me this example about how history, who gets to tell history, who gets to, how history is understood, or it's very powerful. And so you have these female journalists who are understanding Cameroon's past, specifically Cameroon's gender history, and men feel threatened by this. And it's essentially a good example of how, history and storytelling can be a powerful tool.
You just asked these important questions, you know, who gets to tell history and how is the past understood and how was it mitigated by these women writers? So I want to come back to you then. I wonder what was your research process like? Specifically in the context that you conducted your research in, there's an ongoing conflict in Cameroon. Also, given your positionality as a female historian, as a Francophone Cameroonian, tell us more about what that process of researching and writing these histories, what that was like.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I wish these were conversations. I wish I was having more of these conversations when I was a graduate student and trying to choose my topic and sort of understanding the long-term repercussions of what someone's research process is like. When I first started out with the project, it was, to be really honest, it was really hard to convince scholars in the U.S. that Cameroonian history was indeed important, and that indeed it was worth talking about. And I remember having a conversation at conferences and people saying, is there a coup in Cameroon? Is there a civil war? Has the president been taken down? Like, you need to find a better way to basically sexify Cameroon, right? Like people do with South Africa, with Nigeria, with Ghana. And so that was very much a stumbling block, starting out with, to be able to assure myself or to be whole study that, yes, Cameroonian history is important, and that Cameroonian women's history in particular is important. And so I really went to Cameroon with that mindset. But also I had other experiences that perhaps you would relate to that other scholars may not relate to, being someone who was born in Cameroon and most of my family being in Cameroon, how my research process unraveled and unfolded, looked really differently than my other counterparts at that time. And so for me, there were multiple things at play. In 2011, there was a presidential elections, and I put elections in air quotes, going on. And so here I was, a Francophone Cameroonian woman interviewing English-speaking Cameroonians in large, urban towns in Boya and Limbe, and the elections were going on, and people were very suspicious as to why did I want to talk about Anglophone political history during the presidential elections. And I was very visible about the topic of my research. And what would happen was that they would know what the topic was, and then I would start talking or start asking questions about food and clothes. And for them, there's a lot of people that I was interviewing would say, well, but how is this important to Cameroonian political history? Like, what type of questions are you asking here? And it was really interesting after a while, after I had collected about 20 to 25 oral interviews and sort of looked at them across the board, I realized, oh my goodness, they're all saying very similar things about food, cuisine, and clothing. But the journey to access people to interview in itself was originally difficult because of the Francophone Cameroonian background, but also, to be really honest, because of my age, as someone who was in graduate school, at the time, I think I was 28, 29, and looked very young for my age. And the people that I needed to interview were in their late 50s, 60s, 70s. And it was really hard for me to access them because they would look at me and they would say, first of all, you're a doctoral student. Second, here is this woman coming to write about Cameroonian political history, where this is usually a topic that's, as one person said, this is a topic that men write, you know, male historians write this, not a female historian. And so it was difficult accessing people. But this is where, you know, being born in Cameroon and having family members really played a role, because I was really resistant in asking my family for help. And so eventually, when, you know, naturally at some point I broke down and eventually asked my family for help, it was much easier to access people at that point. I had family, family friends, women who were like aunt figures to me. I had my aunts who then got together and they gave me access to their different women's organizations. And they would formally introduce me and they would say, this is my niece and she's going to be a professor and she wants to focus on Cameroon women's history. And they would say how important it was. I mean, so they were sort of, essentially, they would pave the road for me, right? And so then I would have these large group interviews or these one-on-one interviews, and so that was my experience or my research process, and it was one in which I really had to be steady, because it was when I would have family that would you know, they would say, but why are you focusing on Anglophone Cameroonian history? You're from the, you know, you're from the French speaking grassfield region. You need to be writing on our history. Like, what are you doing? And so it was a really, when I look back on it, the research process was a distinct one for someone who was born in one area, but you know, living abroad for the majority of their lives. And it really also gave me the space to understand a lot of stereotypes about Anglophone and Cameroonian history, or Anglophone and Cameroonian people that I grew up with. Conducting oral history in the large towns in English-speaking Cameroon was also a good personal experience for me. It really allowed me to better understand Cameroonian culture and identity. And to be really blunt and frank, it allowed me to understand the stereotypes about Anglophone and Francophone Cameroonian people that I grew up hearing. And also stereotypes about other Africans in Cameroon, such as Nigerians. And so it gave me that historical context to better arm myself or to understand the political landscape of Cameroon today, and to understand how many of these issues are based on stereotypes, are based on creations about national and cultural identity. I'm not saying that they're not important, but I think it is also important to understand how these identities are developed and what the history of that is. And ultimately, you know, this might not be a popular comment. Ultimately, I felt that Cameroonian women throughout the country are more alike than dissimilar. And so that's what I walked away with in understanding these ideas about how we compose ourselves in public and what we cook. These are all themes I see throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's so important that those are some of the conclusions that you reached. And as you say, like, positionality is very important, perhaps like your proximity to what you were studying, but also slight distance because you're not specifically from that part of Cameroon. Yeah, that really brings in another perspective. Look, we've taken up a lot of your time. So to wrap up the interview, I guess the traditional question that I ask all the guests is, what are you working on now? What projects, big or small, are taking your time at the moment?
My second book project, Transnational Histories, Nodes of Encounter and Belonging in Africa, is very different from the first project and has been a very interesting journey. What I've been doing is examining the conversion of thousands of Africans to the Baha'i faith in the 1950s and 1960s to essentially illuminate, to highlight these new transnational histories. And I've been drawing on oral histories of the very first of Baha'i converts in Africa, as well as our archival research to show thus far that through Baha'ism, which is a religion with roots in Iran, that teaches the unity and equality of all religions and people, including gender and racial equality, that these converts, including Cameroonians and Ugandans and Ghanaians, forged new spaces of belonging through becoming Baha'i. They earned elevated positions in the Baha'i administrative system, PhDs at major universities on the continent, as well as Europe and the United States, married into families abroad, and built these transnational businesses. And really in tracing the movements of peoples and cultures and ideas across these diverse spaces, one of the goals or aims I have for this project is really to pay close attention to transnational mobility on the macro and micro levels. And this social mobility and effective networks that African Baha'is made included Black American Baha'i converts, and really facilitated this global pan-African intellectual activism and distinct Black cosmopolitan identities that were grounded in both local and global context. And essentially, for the second book project, I look at how people or Africans who became Baha'i travel across the continent to spread the faith. And I look at the diverse encounters and interactions they have with other Africans, but equally important with Black Americans, specifically Black American women, who are also traversing the African continent at the same time and equally making all these connections with African Baha'is. I mean, it's a really fascinating story, and it's taken me on all sorts of rabbit holes in journeys that I didn't think I would be heading towards. It's been a really fun project.
Yeah, it sounds really fun and really fascinating. And I hope, I hope you'll be back on the podcast to, you know, talk to us about the project when it's completed. But also, I imagine it's going to be a very long project that's going to take you to a lot of places. So, you know, as we get small results from that also, I'm really excited to see what you'll come up with that. Sounds really cool.
Thank you.
I think this will conclude our discussion. So to remind our listeners, this was Dr. Jacqueline Betel-Chuktamgwe, who was presenting her new book, Gender, Separatist Politics, and Embodied Nationalism in Cameroon, that was published in 2019 with Michigan University Press. As we were talking, Jack, you mentioned HNET, so I want to remind everyone, all the listeners, that this interview will be shared on all the networks, including the HNET, social media, Twitter, and wherever it is that you listen to your podcast. So make sure to give this a listen. It was really great. You really gave us like a great overview of women's role in this separatist politics that, you know, a lot of us, including myself growing up on the continent, I was just telling you before the interview, it's only very recently that I started getting a glimpse of this complex history of Cameroon. And even within that, you know, we don't hear about women very often. So like you really did a great job just showing us that. And there's a lot that we didn't discuss in the podcast. You know, you show how these ideas of nationhood emerge in, you know, beauty pageants, in ideas about trousers, who should be wearing trousers and who should not, and really a lot of other areas. So it was really a great book to read. And I hope that everybody that listens to the interview will also afterwards just pick up the book and read it, because there's really a lot that can be learned from it. And thank you again for giving us some of your time today and for coming on the show. It was really great to have you.
Thank you, Medina, for having me.